Sabra, thank you very much for the introduction, and also thank you for inviting me back to the National Press Club. It's a great honour to be back here again. Thank you. At this lunch a year ago, I spoke about the year ahead. As you can see from the slide here, I'm going to talk about the same issue this year. I think perhaps next year as well. 12 months ago, though, I reminded you that at the RBA, unfortunately, we don't have a crystal ball that allows us to see the future with certainty. As you know, since we last met, some things have surprised us and other things have turned out largely as we expected. No doubt the same will be true again this year. Today, though, I want to talk about the year ahead from our perspective, and particularly the central scenario of both the global and domestic economies and some of the factors that we're watching that are going to shape those outcomes. I'd also like, at the end, to touch on monetary policy. I'm going to start off with the global economy, where the central scenario over the next couple of years actually remains quite reasonable. It's important we remember that with all the negativity that's around at the moment. The IMF is expecting global growth next year to be stronger, this year and next year to be stronger than it was last year. As you can see in my first chart, last year the global economy expanded by 2.9%. This year the IMF is expecting growth of 3.3%. and next year 3.4. So it is predicting things will get gradually better. We're not returning to boom times, but things are expected to get gradually better. Looking back though, global growth last year was not as strong as the IMF or we had thought it was going to be. And this was largely because of the trade and technology disputes between the US and China and the Brexit debate in the UK. Both those things had a sobering effect on investment around the world. Every international meeting I went to, the main theme was businesses are uncertain, they're delaying investment. When you're uncertain, you sit on your hands, and I think we saw that last year. There was also an interruption to trade, to global supply chains, and that had a sobering effect on the global economy. I think was the main reason why global growth last year was weaker than the year before. Recently, though, some of the clouds that were hanging over the global economy last year have lifted a little. The progress on the trade dispute between the US and China has helped, and as has the resolution of the Brexit issue. And there have been some encouraging signs recently that the downturn in both international trade and manufacturing activity are coming to an end. And you can see this here in these closely watched PMI indices. It also looks like that the down cycle in the global semiconductor industry, which has been quite a big thing, looks like it's running its course. So together, these are encouraging developments, and they do provide a reasonable basis for us to expect that this year will be better than last year. Having said that, it does remain possible that the expected pickup in growth could be derailed by a further re-escalation of the trade and technology disputes between the US and China, so that remains a risk. The Phase One deal has alleviated the current issues, but has not eliminated them. And of course, as I'll speak about in a few moments, a more recent source of uncertainty is the outbreak of the coronavirus. One other unexpected development over the past year was the easing of monetary policy by most central banks. This easing was in response to both the disappointing growth outcomes in some economies and the continuing accumulation of evidence of low and stable inflation. This evidence seems to suggest pretty clearly to me that the previous relationship between the unemployment rate and inflation has changed. Most countries have unemployment rates at the lowest level in decades. As you can see in this chart, the unemployment rate in the United States at the moment is the lowest that it's been since 1969. And in the United Kingdom, it's the lowest since 1974. And there are a number of other countries where unemployment rates are at 30 and 40-year lows. Despite these very low unemployment rates, inflation remains subdued. And in most countries, it's still below the central bank's target. The reasons for this change are complicated, but my view is that it largely reflects some structural factors related to technology and to globalization, which together have increased competition and increased uncertainty about the future. The result of this is that our economies are less inflation prone than they once were, and it is now possible to sustain lower rates of unemployment than previously thought likely. This is unambiguously a good thing, and it's also the case in Australia. I think we can sustain a lower rate of unemployment than previously thought was possible. Partly as a result of this shift, investors have a very high degree of confidence that interest rates will stay low for a long period of time. This assessment is reinforced by the fact that the global desire to save at the moment is high relative to the global desire to invest. When a lot of people want to save and there's not much demand for those savings by investors by businesses to invest in new capital equipment, the return to savers, that's the interest rate, it's going to be low. That's how supply and demand works. This means that we find ourselves in a world of low unemployment, low inflation, and low interest rates. I expect that we're going to remain here for quite some time to come, given that there are structural factors that are underpinning this combination of low inflation, low unemployment, and low interest rates. Although it is possible that a re-acceleration of growth in economies that are already at fairly close to full capacity could see inflation re-emerge, well, I think that probability that's quite low. One consequence of interest rates being lower for longer is that asset prices have increased as investors discount future returns by less. The most obvious example of this is global equity prices, which have recorded very strong gains over recent times, notwithstanding the falls that we've seen last week due to the virus. Some investors are also taking on more risk as they search for higher returns in a low interest rate world. Both higher asset prices and a willingness to take on more risk can be good for the global economy. In some ways, we need that. But it can only be good if it leads to more investment in new productive capital, not just more borrowing. So it is possible to have too much of a good thing, and we're alert to that risk. And so are the international bodies that I'm a part of, including the Financial Stability Board, looking at the effect of low interest rates on risk appetite and on asset prices. And the hope is that a greater desire to take risk and higher asset prices will encourage more capital formation, not more borrowing. If it just encourages more borrowing, then I think we're going to have some problems. I would now like to turn to the Australian economy. We'll be releasing an updated set of forecasts on Friday and our statement on monetary policy. But ahead of that, I can provide you with the key numbers and some of the main issues shaping the outlook. Our central forecast is for the Australian economy to expand by 2.75% this year and 3% next year. You can see that in this chart. These growth rates are a little above our current estimates of medium-term growth in the Australian economy. So if these forecasts are realised, we should make some inroads into spare capacity in our economy. As you can see, these growth rates are also higher than the outcomes we achieved in 2018 and 19, where growth was on average around 2%. We're expecting that to step up to be closer to 3%. As I've been saying for some time, we're passing through a gentle turning point for the better, and the recent data have been consistent with that. There are a number of factors that are underpinning this outlook. The expected pickup in world growth should help. The resources sector is finally in expansion mode again after 7 years of contraction. We're expecting consumer spending to pick up, and I'll have more to say about that in a moment. The outlook is also being supported by high levels of investment in infrastructure, and the downswing in residential construction activity, which has took place last year, is coming to an end. Expect to see further increases in resource exports, and there's continuing solid growth in public demand. So together, I think those things should give us confidence that growth rates are going to lift from 2 to be closer to 3. In terms of the labour market, as you can see in this next chart, we're expecting the unemployment rate to remain around its current level for a while yet, but then start declining again to be below 5% later next year as economic growth picks up. One consideration here is the outlook for labour force participation. Over the past couple of years, we've seen a very large rise in participation, particularly by women and by older Australians. It's a positive development, it's a good thing. But it has meant that the very strong employment growth that we've seen has not reduced the unemployment rate. We've seen very strong demand for labour, which is good, but that's been met with very strong growth in labour supply as well. So it's demand and supply again. Strong growth in demand, strong growth in supply. The price of labour, that is the wage rate, really hasn't really changed very much. So that's the world we're in, and I expect we're going to stay in that world where labour demand and labour supply are going to be pretty well matched over the next year. In terms of inflation, we expect to see a gradual increase in underlying terms, with inflation expected to approach 2% over the next couple of years. The recent inflation data were pretty much in line with our expectations, but it is worth pointing out that there are quite contrasting trends within the Consumer Price Index at the moment. We're seeing higher price increases for groceries, meat and dairy than we've seen for quite a few years, but on the other hand, there are very subdued outcomes for housing, especially rents, which are growing at the slowest rate in decades, and utility prices, particularly electricity prices, are now declining after they've risen for many years. So that's the broad overview, broad numbers. I now want to focus on three issues. The first is the ongoing adjustment in household balance sheets in Australia. The second is the bushfires, the drought and the coronavirus. And the third is a longer term one, and that's the importance of continuing to invest in our future. Looking back at the last year, economic growth in Australia was weaker than we had expected. The global slowdown is part of the story, but the more important factor is a domestic one, and that subdued growth in consumer spending as households adjusted to slow wages growth and a decline in housing prices. And we also saw a decline in residential construction last year, which was a factor. Over 2019 as a whole, as you can see in this chart, household consumption growth slowed. It looks to have risen by only around 1% over the year. You need to remember our population is growing quite quickly at 1.5% a year. So consumption's up 1, population's up 1.5. That implies a contraction in per capita terms. That's a very unusual outcome in an economy that's recorded the type of very strong jobs growth that we've seen in Australia over the past few years. So it's interesting to think about why that's happening. For some time now, it's been pretty clear that households have been gradually adjusting to slower growth in their income. It would appear that this adjustment accelerated last year in response to falling housing prices. Faced with the reality of slow growth in wages and falling housing prices, many households scaled back their spending to put their finances and their balance sheets on sounder footing, and it's the case that the effects of this have been felt right across the economy. On the wages front, Australians have been getting used to increases of 2 point something. As you can see in this chart, this is a noticeable step down from the 3 to 4% range we experienced previously, and we're forecasting the current rate of wage growth to remain around its current level for a few years yet. We're not expecting wage growth to pick up over the next couple of years. So we're having collectively to get used to wages rising at 2 point something, not 3 point something. As this period of low wage growth has run on, many people have adjusted down their expectations of how fast they think their own income will grow in the future. Most people have come to accept that their wages will rise at 2 point something, not 3 point something. At the same time that we've been collectively making this adjustment, last year we had to deal with another adjustment, that is lower housing prices. Between late 2017 and mid last year, nationwide measures of housing prices fell 8%. You can see this in this chart. And in Sydney and Melbourne, the average decline in housing prices was 13%. The speed and the extent of this decline came as a shock to many people, although it did follow an earlier large run-up in prices, as we all know. It reminded us all, though, that housing prices can and sometimes do fall substantially. For some people, the salutary effect of that reminder has been amplified by lower wage increases and high levels of debt. As part of the Reserve Bank's efforts to understand households who are adjusting to this new world, we've been looking very carefully recently at data on mortgage repayments and I'd like to share those updated data with you today. And this graph shows housing loan repayments as a share of outstanding credit, broken down into interest payments, that's in the top panel, and repayments of principal, including through higher repayments of voluntary repayments of principal and higher balances in offset accounts. And the vertical lines in this graph show when we've cut interest rates. There are three points that I want to draw your attention to. The first is that as monetary policy has been eased since late 2011, interest payments as a share of credit and of income have both come down. You can see that in the top panel. This has freed up income for people to spend on other purposes, and it's helped support the economy. The second point is that the rate of repayment of principal has moved up and down over time. These fluctuations partly reflect trends in the housing market, in particular the increases in repayments in 2014 and 15 were associated with strong growth in offset accounts and coincided with a period of high turnover in the housing market and strong growth in loan refinancing. And the third point, and the one that I really want to focus on, is that over the second half of last year, principal payments increased noticeably. You can see that on the right-hand side there, that increase in the blue bar. The increase in principal repayments has more than offset the decline in interest payments. Households have made both larger voluntary repayments and they've maintained higher balances in their offset accounts. Partly this has been made possible by the tax refunds for low and middle income earners, but there's more than that going on here. It's not the full story. I think it's entirely understandable that households faced with low wages growth and falling housing prices sought to repay their debts a bit more quickly. I'm going to speak about monetary policy shortly, but ahead of that I'd like to address one point that I hear frequently and I think many in this room have written about, and that is that the Reserve Bank's decision to cut interest rates last year dented consumer confidence, and this is what lies behind the weak growth in consumer spending. I certainly understand that having interest rates at very low levels has unsettled some people, and many of those people write to me each day. But I do not accept the idea that this is what is driving weak consumption growth in Australia. There's something deeper going on here. While the Reserve Bank's decisions have reminded people of what's going on, Australians already understood the situation, and they were already adjusting their spending to the reality of a combination of weaker growth in wages, the fall in housing prices, and high levels of debt. Consumer confidence and monetary policy were both responding to this reality. My judgment is that if the Reserve Bank had not eased monetary policy last year, this adjustment by households would have been harder. The balance sheet repair would have been more difficult, and the economy would have been weaker. The lower interest rates have assisted with both sides of the balance sheet. They've allowed people to pay down their debts a bit more quickly, and they've also boosted asset prices, so they've boosted the value of people's assets, their houses and their equities. So the reductions in interest rates are helping, not hampering, the process of balance sheet adjustment in Australia. In doing so, they are bringing forward the day when households feel comfortable to start spending again at a higher rate. However, as I said when discussing the global situation, we need to remember that it is possible to have too much of a good thing, and I'll return to this idea when discussing monetary policy. We are aware of the risk of low interest rates encouraging too much borrowing and driving excessive asset valuations, so we're going to continue to watch borrowing in particular very carefully in the period ahead. The main point here, though, is that we expect consumption growth to strengthen as households become more comfortable with their balance sheets. Assisting with this, we're expecting stronger growth in disposable income over the next couple of years than we've seen over the past couple of years. Housing prices, you know, are all rising again, not falling, and we're expecting a pickup in residential construction activity this year. The unemployment rate's also expected to remain steady and then to decline, and I'm hoping that gives people the confidence to spend again. So it is reasonable to expect that things improve from here, although it's hard to be precise just how long this period of balance sheet adjustment is going to run on. I'd now like to turn to the second issue, and that's the effect of the devastating bushfires over the summer, the drought and the coronavirus. On behalf of the Reserve Bank Board and staff, I would like to extend our thoughts to all those who've been affected by the bushfires, especially to those who so tragically lost loved ones. I'd also like to extend our deep gratitude to all those who've worked so tirelessly to control the fires. We'd like to thank those people for their service and for their sacrifice for the country. The economic impact of these fires in the areas affected has been very large. There have been very significant disruptions to normal economic activity in those areas. There's been large-scale destruction of homes, farms and businesses, wildlife and public infrastructure. So they've been a major event. In assessing the impact of this on the Australian economy as a whole, though, we've also taken into account that there will be a material rebuilding effort and that government grants and insurance payments will assist some people as well. On this basis, our assessment is that GDP growth for Australia as a whole this year will be largely unaffected by the bushfires. There is, however, likely to be a noticeable effect in the December quarter last year and the quarter we're currently in. While it's difficult to be precise, we estimate that the effects of the bushfires will reduce GDP growth by around 0.2 of a percentage point across the two quarters. But after we take into account the rebuilding effort for the year as a whole, we don't think the effect is going to be material. But it's very significant in the areas affected, but for the country as a whole, it's not likely to affect growth for the year. We're also continuing to assess the effects of the drought on the economy. Farm output declined by 16% between 2017 and 19, and farm exports fell by 13%. These are big declines. A further decline in farm production of around 10% is expected this year, and that's likely to represent a drag of another 0.25% on GDP growth this year. So the drought over the year is having a material effect on GDP growth. I think it serves for us all as a stark reminder that the economic effects of these climate events are very material and they're something we have to take into account. As I said, in discussing the global environment, a new uncertainty affecting the Australian economy is the outbreak of the coronavirus. I think it is too early to tell what the overall impact will be, but the SARS outbreak in 2003 may provide a guide. On that occasion, there was a very sharp slowing in output growth in China. It lasted a few months. That was followed by a very sharp bounce back as the outbreak was controlled and economic stimulus measures were put in place. Today, China is a larger part of the global economy and it's more closely integrated with other economies, including our own. So we're expecting the international spillovers could be larger than they were at the time of SARS. Really, much will depend upon the success of the various efforts to control the virus. And until we know how successful those efforts are going to be, it's very hard to predict the economic impact. It's quite possible we could see the same thing as we saw in SARS, a contraction followed by a sharp rebound. But if the health authorities have trouble controlling the virus, the effects could be much more material, and we just don't at this point know. It's too hard to tell. The third issue that I'd like to discuss is the importance of continuing to invest in our future. Australia's economic fundamentals remain very strong, and they provide a solid foundation for us to be optimistic about our country's future. The fundamentals include world-class endowments of natural resources, a highly skilled and innovative workforce, an established and predictable regulatory system, sound public finances, a diverse and growing population, and the fact that we're well placed to benefit from the strong growth in Asia, not just in China, but also in the populous countries of Indonesia and India. So I think it's worth occasionally to sit back and reflect that we do have a lot to feel fortunate about. We enjoy a set of fundamentals and a standard of living that few other countries in the world enjoy. Most countries envy the position that we're in. I think it's really important we don't lose sight of that.
Strong fundamentals, though, can only take us so far. If we are to turn these fundamentals into strong and consistent growth, we need to keep investing in our future. As you can see from this chart, which is my final one, the level of investment spending in Australia relative to the size of the economy has trended lower over recent years, although there's been some increase in public investment recently. At the same time we've seen this decline in investment as a share of GDP, we've also experienced a troubling decline in productivity growth. While the reasons for this decline in productivity growth are complex, I find it hard to escape the conclusion that higher levels of investment spending would promote productivity growth and our collective welfare. The list of areas where additional investments would improve our future prospects, I think, is well known to you all. It includes investments in infrastructure, in human capital, in energy production and distribution, in new data technologies, and in measures to deal with climate change and its effects. Businesses, as well as governments across Australia, are addressing these issues. I think it's in our collective interest that they remain focused on them. Both public and business sector balance sheets are in pretty good shape at the moment, and they're strong enough to take advantage of these investment opportunities in these areas. As I've said on other occasions, low interest rates should make it easier for both public and the business sectors to contemplate long-term investments, given that future returns don't need to be discounted as much when you've got low interest rates. Low interest rates also mean the financing costs are lower. And with interest rates at record lows and likely to remain low for a long period of time, there are plenty of opportunities here, and I think we need to keep investing in our future. If we don't, then productivity growth will stay low, and if productivity growth is low, our wages don't rise as quickly, the value of our companies don't rise as quickly, and the government finances are more stretched. So it's in our collective interest that we address the productivity issues we currently face, and there's no shortage of good investment ideas out there. Our balance sheets are in good shape, and interest rates are low. So I encourage people to think about investing again in this country with our fabulous fundamentals. I would now like to finish by returning to monetary policy. As you probably read this morning at the Reserve Bank Board's meeting yesterday, we decided that the best course at the moment was to hold the cash rate steady at 0.75%. The recent inflation and unemployment data were both in line with our expectations, and they do show things moving in the right direction, well, I would have to say only gradually. Over the next couple of years, we expect further progress to be made towards full employment and the inflation target, although that progress is likely to remain quite gradual, quite slow. The fact that the progress we're making is only gradual reflects some significant structural shifts in the global economy related to technology and globalisation, and as I spoke about earlier, the balance sheet adjustment that we're seeing in Australian households. Monetary policy has already responded to these factors, and it is providing considerable support to the Australian economy. Notwithstanding this, given the outlook that I've talked about today, the board has continued to discuss the merits of further monetary stimulus in an effort to speed the pace of progress and to make it more assured. On balance, though, the board has decided to hold the cash rate steady, recognising the significant monetary stimulus that's already been put in place and the very long and variable lags associated with monetary policy. This decision also reflects a judgment about the benefits from a further reduction in interest rates against some of the costs and risks associated with very low interest rates in Australia. It certainly remains the case that a further reduction in interest rates would help with the balance sheet adjustments that households are undertaking, and that would help bring forward the day that consumption increases again. I think lower interest rates would also have a further effect on the exchange rate, which would boost our exports and in time support jobs growth. On the other side of the equation, though, there are risks in having interest rates at very low levels. Internationally, there are increased concerns about the effects of low interest rates on resource allocation in the economy and their effects on the confidence of many people in our community. Lower interest rates could also encourage more borrowing by households eager to buy residential property at a time when there's already quite a strong upswing in the property market taking place. If that occurs, and we saw a further borrowing and a big increase in housing prices, that could increase the risk of further problems down the track. So there is a balance to be struck here, and the Reserve Bank Board is seeking to strike that balance. The Board recognises the nature of this balance can change over time, and it depends very much upon the state of the economy. So it's continually looking at both sides of the equation. If the unemployment rate were to be trending in the wrong direction, and there was no further progress being made towards the inflation target, I think the balance of the arguments would change. In those circumstances, the Board would see a stronger case for further monetary easing. So I can assure you we're going to continue to monitor developments very carefully, including in the labour market. We're going to try and seek the right balance in the interests of the community as a whole. So thank you very much for listening and for attending this lunch, and I look forward to answering your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Governor. When the Board sat down yesterday to discuss the impacts of what's happened in Australia in the last 2 months, particularly the bushfires, did the Board, as well as discussing the immediate impacts on the economy, you've mentioned in your speech that you're also factoring in climate change, but is there more thinking and consideration going into whether this is a one-off event or it's something that Australia and the Board needs to be factoring in, might be a more frequent event, given what Ross Garnaut was saying more than a decade ago?
We didn't have yesterday an extended discussion of that particular issue. We had a lot of other things on our agenda, but I think it's pretty clear that average temperatures are rising and they're more variable. And we know that is going to have economic consequences in Australia and around the world. We're not part of the kind of the debate about what to do about it, but our job is to try and understand the economic and financial effects. I think we're seeing climate change affect patterns of production and distribution and investment. We're seeing the cost and availability of insurance change, which is going to affect where people invest. It's clearly affecting the value of some existing assets. Money is going to have to spend on mitigation and adaptation. That's money we can't spend elsewhere. And it's also opening up the possibility of new industries. The fact that it's affecting the value of assets and can likely do that in the future means that there are financial stability implications over time. We're likely to see at some point some stranded assets and their value falls. So we've been encouraging financial institutions together with APRA to understand those risks. As part of our efforts, we're joining with other regulators through the Council of Financial Regulators to understand the financial risks, and a number of my colleagues are involved in international discussions as well. So I think the effects are profound, and our job is really to try and understand them as best we can.
Thank you, Governor. As I call upon my colleagues, could you please also identify the organisation you work with? Matt Wade.
Matt Wade from the Sydney Morning Herald.
Hello. I'd like to ask you about unemployment, which you mentioned in your speech. Your charts showed that our unemployment rate is a fair bit higher than some of our peers, like the US, the UK and New Zealand. It's been at 5% for more than a decade, or around most of this decade. And the total number of people out of work in Australia has been above 700,000 for some time. I've got 3 points I'd like to ask you. Does the RBA board ever have a formal process of talking to or hearing from unemployed people in the course of your deliberations? Are there policy settings that could be changed to reduce the unemployment rate further in a faster time frame than you're talking about? Or should we just simply adjust to a unemployment rate around 5%?
Three good questions. Perhaps before I answer them, can I point out one other fact? In Australia, the ratio of employment to population is as high as it's ever been. A higher share of the Australian population have a job today than they've ever had in the past, and the share of Australians that have a job is higher than the share of the Americans that have a job. So even though their unemployment rate is lower, there are a lot of people who are kind of detached from the labour force and just aren't participating. You know, it would be great to have a lower unemployment rate, but in Australia we have a very high labour force participation now, and as I said, a higher share of the population have a job than ever before. So the unemployment rate isn't kind of the only summary statistic of what's going in the labour market. Over recent years, we've had extraordinarily strong employment growth in Australia. It's averaged 2.5%, and the population's only growing 1.5%. And we haven't made further progress in reducing unemployment rate, the unemployment rate, because there's been an increase in labour supply and increased participation. So I think we need to keep that in mind. Your three questions. Do we have a program of talking to unemployed people? The answer to that's no. But we do talk to a lot of community organisations that help support unemployed people, so we have a sense through those discussions about what the issues that people face. Are there further policy settings that could be adjusted to reduce unemployment? We're doing what we can. I think we've got very stimulatory monetary policy. Our expectation and hope is that eventually that will do enough to drive the unemployment rate lower. And it's really up to the government to decide whether they would want to use fiscal policy. That's the other policy tool, and that's really up to them. And the third question is, do we just have to accept higher unemployment? The answer to that is no. Our strategy is to keep interest rates low, hopefully for a long period of time. That will allow more investment in the economy. People will have more confidence. They'll hire people. And gradually we'll get the unemployment rate down. We'd like to see it come down more quickly, but we have to be realistic. We feel like we're doing what we can to support low unemployment in the country, and it's working. I mean, the employment growth has been strong. We'd like it to be more, the unemployment rate to come down more quickly, but there's a limit to what we at the central bank can achieve here.
Colleagues, there. Also, I should have said, we do have a long list of journalists. Could we please stick to one question per person? Philip Lasker,
ABC Governor. Coronavirus, bushfires, drought, ongoing drought, the one thing that hasn't changed are your growth forecasts. I'm just wondering, is what's happening now any sort of a wake-up call for policymakers, the RBA and government, and to what extent is their response to these problems inhibiting or headwinds for economic growth and the economy? Are we too reliant on China, perhaps? Should we be taking more aggressive action on climate change? Would they all help us get through these problems more easily?
You started off with the premise that our growth forecasts haven't changed, and that's true for the year-end growth rates for 2020 and 21. Because we largely see the fires and the virus as having a short-term impact on growth. So when we publish our growth forecasts, you'll see that year-end growth, so the June quarter, will be lower. But we're expecting lower growth in the short term and then bounce back as the recovery takes place, and hopefully the virus gets under control and there'll be economic stimulus in China and we'll see a bounce back. So there is an effect right now. And it's going to last for a while, we hope, and then we'll see a bounce back. So for the year as a whole, we're not expecting a material effect. Is kind of a wake-up call? That's kind of beyond my area of expertise. The one thing that I do think would really help is this focus on investment. I think the country does face a challenge in lifting productivity growth. That's, these issues we're dealing with at the moment, and the virus and the fires, they're significant, but hopefully they're temporary. Over time, to really make a difference to our living standards, we've got to lift productivity growth, and there's no shortage of ideas for the country to be investing in. We have fantastic fundamentals, and I would like to see kind of more investment, and I don't know whether it's a wake-up call, but it should be a challenge to us all. What can we do to lift productivity growth to drive increases in our living standards?
Michael Pascoe.
Michael Pascoe, The New Daily. Governor, has the combination of bushfires, the coronavirus and bad news polls achieved what economic argument could not. Do you expect more fiscal stimulus from the federal government, net fiscal stimulus?
I'm responsible for monetary policy. So I don't know what the expectation is. I think we will see, some additional spending to help people that have been affected by the bushfires. Whether that counts as fiscal stimulus, I'll leave others to determine that. So, I'm not going to say what the government's going to do. It's not my area of responsibility.
The Treasury Secretary sits on your board. What he knew, did that have any bearing on your decision yesterday?
He's a board member, so he has the same bearing as the other eight board members. I think longer term, there is an issue about the intersection of monetary and fiscal policy. The standard way of thinking for the last 20 years has been that monetary policy really is a stabiliser, it deals with the economic cycle, and fiscal policy just deals with structural issues. But with interest rates as low as they are, there is limited scope in the future, probably, for monetary policy to play exactly the same role that it used to play. We don't have the capacity to lower interest rates a lot further, and we have some other tools, but how effective they're going to be, we're unsure. So I think there is a debate or a discussion that we'll have to have, that the economics profession, the community will have to have over time, is does the relationship between monetary and fiscal policy change, and should fiscal policy play a greater role in economic stabilisation? It's not a reflection on where we are right now, but I think we need to think about that issue over time. Is there more that fiscal policy can do if monetary policy can't do it, or are there so many problems in using fiscal policy that it's just too hard to do? This discussion is taking place between the Reserve Bank and Treasury, and in the international forums that I go to with the other central bank governors, it's something we talk about a lot. If we're constrained, what else can be done? And one thing that could be done is using fiscal policy, but fiscal policy comes with problems as well.
Swati Pandey.
Hi, Governor. This is Swati from Reuters. My question is it fair to say that the board no longer sees a strong case for easing? Is the bar high now? And secondly, when you talk about unemployment trending lower, what time frame are you looking at? Are you looking at 2 months of data before you make the decision, 3 months, 6 months? What's your time frame? Thank you.
I wouldn't quite frame it as the board doesn't see a strong case for easing. I can see the case for further easing. As I said, it would help with the balance sheet adjustment. It would have the effect on the exchange rate. But there are risks with very low interest rates, and we need to balance those risks off against the benefits we get. At the moment, we're projecting some progress towards full employment and a lift in inflation over time. So where we sit right at the moment, it didn't seem that the benefits that we would get from lower interest rates right now would outweigh those risks. That could change, and I can't put for you a time frame on when that might happen, and there's no critical level of the unemployment rate we're looking at, but if we thought things were moving in the wrong direction, we'd see the benefits of lower interest rates be greater and the risks being less, so that balance would change. But we're not thinking about it in terms of numbers or dates, but that's the general story. Are things still moving in the right direction, which I think at the moment they are? If they're not, then either us or the government would have to do something.
One risk of cutting rates further would be another flood of letters on your desk. Do you respond to those letters personally?
I do, as long as they're not abusive. If people are rude to me, then I tend not to respond, but many of the people who write to me, I have a great deal of empathy for that. The typical letter would say, I've saved hard all my life, I've tried to be conservative, I'm holding my money in term deposits because I don't want to invest in the equity markets because I'm in my 70s or 80s or even older, and I'm finding it very, very difficult. And I have, at a personal level, I have a great deal of empathy for that. So, right, as long as people are not abusive, and some people find it appropriate to be very abusive. As long as they're not, I try and write back, yes.
Jamie Smythe.
Good afternoon, Governor. This week marks the anniversary...
Stand up, please.
Good afternoon, Governor. This week marks the anniversary of the Royal Commission into Misconduct in the financial services sector. Can you say with any certainty, 1 year on, that there is cultural change that has taken place within the financial institutions and within the regulators? And are there any specific areas where you would point out that more needs to be done? Thank you.
Yeah, well, it's a very good question. I think kind of 1 year on, I think we're seeing that, well, something that I said at the time, there is benefit from showing the spotlight on what was going on in the banking sector. Now, the sunlight has really kind of helped clean things up a bit. I'm confident that we're going to have a stronger and better financial system that serves people's interests more effectively as a result of the Royal Commission. You ask, am I confident that there's been cultural change? I think it's not kind of a yes or no answer to that. There is a process of cultural change going on. And I see that. I see financial institutions being more focused on service and customer outcomes rather than sales. But this is a process. I see financial institutions more seriously addressing conflict of interest issues than they did in the past. There is a much greater focus on accountability with inside financial institutions. And from my discussions with a number of boards, I sense a much greater focus on non-financial risks rather than just kind of maximising the kind of short-term profits. So this is a process that's going on. It's not something that changes overnight. It probably takes many years, but I see enough signs that process is taking place that I have confidence about the future. Within the regulators, I know there's been a significant change. I chair the Council of Financial Regulators, and I see that there's much greater focus on enforcement than there was previously. And from many perspectives, that's a good thing. From the perspective of prudential regulation, I think we can move too far towards an enforcement mentality, because one of the things about prudential regulation is supervision is as important as regulation. And I've seen over the years many cases where APRA and previously at the Reserve Bank would be speaking to financial institutions about what was going on, suggesting the board they kind of rethink something or move in a different direction. It's not as a result of some black letter law, some enforcement action. It's a result of supervision and an open and constructive relationship with the regulated entities. So I think it's really important we achieve that. So a much greater focus on enforcement, but we at the same time, and I think APRA recognises this, supervision is actually as an important tool as enforcement, and we can't lose sight of that.
Jonathan Shapiro.
Thanks, Governor Lowe. I had two very quick questions. One is, do you think the coronavirus exposes our economic reliance on China? And the second question is, are you comfortable with the current level of the Australian dollar?
On the virus, does it expose our reliance on China? I think it highlights it, but we all knew that anyhow, didn't we? You know, China's the source of the destination of most of exports. It's incredibly important increasingly for tourism and for higher education. So we all knew that, so I don't think we needed the coronavirus to kind of tell us that. As I said, in the SARS case, we did see a sharp contraction in China's output, you know, 2% in one quarter, and then it did bounce back. It's quite possible we see the same thing this time. I think the interruption to the Chinese economy in the short term may be greater. I've seen estimates that say that air and rail transport have fallen 70%, spending in some areas is down a long way, and we're now starting to hear some examples of interruptions of supply chains affecting production elsewhere, not just in China but around the world. So it's possible that the effects are bigger. But we also saw on the weekend the Chinese central bank announce some measures to support the economy, and the Chinese president also said on the weekend that they will announce stimulus measures, particularly in the infrastructure space. So I think it's important we don't catastrophise here. You know, it's possible this does not work out well, but it's also possible that the SARS experience is a reasonable guide to what happens here. Sorry, I lost track of the second question. Am I allowed to answer a second
I was going to say that might be the benefit of losing track of the second question, that we might move on. Peter Ryan.
Dr. Lowe, Peter Ryan from the ABC. As journalists, we're always looking for colour, light and shade in our reporting, so it's great to have you here for 2 years in a row. But just on the climate change matter, and you've now indicated that that's, you know, well and truly factored into monetary policy deliberations, what sort of discussions, debates or arguments might you have within the RBA board about climate change, particularly in the lead-up to the bushfires that we saw? And as other people are asking a secondary question, I'll ask one. What's your message to climate change deniers, particularly those who might be in certain parts of the government?
I have no message. It's not my responsibility to, or appropriate for me to be giving messages on that topic. We have no role in climate change policy. But what I am responsible for is understanding what's going on in the economy and how higher temperatures and more variable climate affects financial risks. So that's very much our focus, as I said, in response to the first question. And it's not my role. It would be inappropriate for me to kind of be sending messages to government how to deal with this issue. It's a matter for the Parliament and for business to deal with. And all the central bank can do is respond to the world we face. And that world is a hotter one and with more variable weather, and that has economic and financial impacts. And we try and understand those.
Jessica Irvine.
Jess Irvine, Sydney Morning Herald and Age Newspapers. Happy New Year, Phil. Did you get a chance to go away on a holiday, and where did you go? Because economists are saying that you've come back rather optimistic about the future of the Australian economy. And I might like to go there next year. And a second question. Last year we had a fun debate on semantics about the difference between a coin toss, 50-50, 52, 48, regarding the future probability of interest rate movements. You stood up last year and shifted from it being a situation of rates more likely to go up than down, and you axed that and said evenly balanced, and then we went into a year where you cut interest rates three times, so you must have thought at some point rates were more likely to go down than up. So this year, are you evenly balanced, or do you agree with the statement that interest rates are more likely to go down than up from here?
It's two big questions that are kind of quite a way apart from one another. I had a three-week holiday. As most of you the journalists would know, the Reserve Bank Board does not meet in January. So that's the only time I get to of the year I get to have a break, and I've got three teenage children, and so it's good to spend time with them. We had 1 week at home, and then we went to California for 2 weeks as well. I spent time in San Francisco and Palm Springs playing golf with my three kids. So that was a lot of fun. In terms of the balance of probabilities on interest rates, you're right. Last year, there was a switch to kind of essentially 50-50. At the moment, the probability of an interest rate increase anytime soon is very low. Things would have to change kind of tremendously for us to be even contemplating higher interest rates. It's possible that interest rates could come down. I'm hoping that that does not happen, because the scenario in which we would be reducing interest rates is one we're not making progress towards full employment and the inflation target. It's possible that we don't make further progress, that we find that growth disappoints again on the downside. So the probability of an interest rate cut is obviously higher than an increase. My hope, and I think it's a reasonable expectation, is that we could have a period of stability again as we continue to make progress. We get through these current interruptions to growth, obviously, in the December and the March quarters. And beyond that, we benefit from the fact that households are getting their balance sheets in a better position, the housing market's rising, the residential construction sector is in an upswing, and the resource sector is in expansion mode in terms of investment for the first time in 7 years. Those things, I'm hoping, will be enough to get progress towards full employment and inflation target. But if we don't see that progress, or we think it's a serious risk, I think it's right to have interest rates back on the agenda.
Jess Ayenko.
Jess Ayenko, 10 News. Governor, what is the RBA planning to do to stop banks gouging retailers with tap-and-go fees?
I guess here you're referring to least cost routing. For those who are not aware of this issue, when you use your debit card at a machine, the tap-and-go one, most debit cards allow you to route that transaction either through the Visa MasterCard schemes or the FPOS scheme. And for the merchant, it's much cheaper if it's routed through the FPOS scheme rather than the international scheme fees. So the merchant pays a lot less. You know, most of the time, not all the time, but almost all the time, I as a consumer don't care which payments rails it goes through. I just want it to come out of my account and pay for the goods and services. And we have made it very clear to the banking industry that we expect them to develop the functionality to allow the merchant to choose which payment rails it goes through, the international schemes or the FPOS schemes. And we've put quite a lot of pressure on the banks to do this. My understanding is that they've now all developed the technology and solutions, and we're encouraging the merchants to actually go to their banks and say, turn on this functionality for me. So what we're doing at the moment is bringing attention to the issue and encouraging merchants to actually ask for their banks for the better deal. If that process doesn't work, then we would have to consider a regulatory solution. Regulating here is not the preferred option, but is a fallback option if we don't see the required change.
Peter Switzer.
Peter Switzer from switzer.com.au and Sky News. Some people in the media are really lucky in the sense that they get to watch movie stars and sports stars, but most of us here watch you.
I'm sorry.
I know, but it's a tough job. Some of us have to do it. And we try to guess the way you're thinking, and you've given me a bit of a hint just a moment ago by saying most of us think that you don't really want to cut interest rates anymore. You'd like to think this economy could come good where rates are now. But I also know you're an economist, and therefore you know that the budget deficit is a really important part of what might happen to interest rates. So what number do you want to see for the budget deficit in May when Josh Frydenberg speaks? And will you be, you know, what number will make you really happy and you just jump out of your chair and go, yes, well done, Josh. What number is that?
Well, I'm not prone to jump out of my chair. And certainly the budget normally doesn't encourage me to do that. I know there's a lot of public discussion on kind of the surplus and how big it should be, and whether the government should do more or less. I understand why everyone's interested in that issue, but for me it's not the main issue. Whether the government has a small budget or a surplus from an economic perspective is not particularly important. I think there are two real issues, though, kind of in fiscal space that we should be talking about over time, and I've touched on one of them, and that's the relative roles of fiscal and monetary policy and economic stabilisation. That's a much more important issue than whether we have a small surplus or a small deficit. And the second one is, what scope is there for fiscal policy and government policy to address the investment issues I talked about? You know, you can undertake investments that don't affect the current budget deficit. There's been an increase in public investment. We've seen the federal government with a 10-year, $100 billion program, and the state governments are investing in infrastructure as well. In an environment where interest rates are very low, I think yesterday the government's borrowing costs for 10 years were essentially the lowest they've been since Federation. So are there investments that the government could make or could encourage the private sector to make that would yield risk-adjusted rates of return greater than the lowest interest rates on record? I think that's a much more important issue for us to be thinking about. Can the government use its balance sheet or create an environment where the private sector wants to use its balance sheet to undertake the investments the country needs? I encourage you to all think about that issue much more than whether it's a budget or deficit or surplus. What would make me jump out of my chair is kind of a renewed kind of enthusiasm for investment in the country, because I think that's in our collective interest.
Governor, we're almost at time. Would you take a couple more questions, please?
I'm in your hands.
Fantastic. Ricardo Gonzalez.
Governor Ricardo Gonsalves from SBS. Just a quick one on the coronavirus again. Would you be surprised if we saw negative GDP as a result of the coronavirus, say, in this quarter?
I would be surprised. I mean, we're only 1 month through the March quarter. We've got 2 months to go. I mean, to get a negative quarter in this this quarter, I would expect, I think we'd have to see kind of an acceleration of the problems and intensification, the efforts that the Chinese and others have made to contain it not be successful. Because I think we're starting to see mining investment pick up. I'm hopeful the balance sheet process that the households have been going through that I talked about will see consumption growth pick up and the decline from residential construction activities coming to an end. So I think there's enough positives there. I think we'll only see a negative if the current situation isn't contained.
Cheryl Bagwell.
Hi. Stand up. Unfortunately, most of my ideas have been taken, but on that business investment, because I've been away for a year, come back to 3 interest rate cuts in a year, another one expected, but still, as you say, business investment remains extraordinarily sluggish. So why aren't those cuts working? Second quick question, unemployment is the key as to whether we get another cut, you suggested. How much do you take into account Australia's extraordinary level of underemployment when you calculate where monetary policy goes?
On underemployment, we look at it very carefully. I mean, I often use unemployment as a shorthand. I probably should say unemployment and underemployment, but it becomes kind of a mouthful, as you would appreciate. So each time at our board meetings and in our internal discussions, we're looking at underemployment all the time, and there's quite a lot of underemployment, and that's largely coming about from people who are working part-time who would like more hours. Now, a third of the workforce in Australia now work part-time, which from many perspectives is kind of a really good thing. We're seeing kind of a lot of people have options. When I was first entering the workforce, you either worked 40 hours or zero. Now you can work 5 or 10 or 25, and so that's from some people's perspective. That's good, and I think that would be my perspective as well. But there are a group of people who actually want more hours, and we take that into account when we're thinking about the strength of the labour market and inflation pressures. You said that you didn't think the interest rate cuts were working. At the moment, they're not working to lift public private investment, and I wouldn't expect them to in the short term anyhow, but I just want to push back against the idea that interest rate cuts are not working. Today, we've got the lowest exchange rate in more than, I think, a decade. That's not unrelated to our decisions on interest rates, and the lower exchange rate is making businesses more competitive, and that supports jobs. And the lower interest rates are helping with this process of balance sheet adjustment. If you accept the idea that the households were adjusting to lower wage growth and falling housing prices, do you think that adjustment would have been easier or harder if we'd had higher interest rates? The proposition that I put in my remarks is it would have been harder if we'd had higher interest rates. The lower interest rates have allowed people to pay off their debts a bit more quickly, and it's boosted the value of their assets and getting their balance sheets into a more comfortable position more quickly. That's helping. So I see they're the two main channels through the easing of monetary, through which the easing of monetary policy over the past year has helped. In time, if consumers start spending again and the exchange rate's at a better level, that will lift business investment because people will feel better about the future. So that's the process, but it takes time. And in yesterday's statement, in my remarks today, I talk about the long and variable lags. This is why there are long and variable lags. It takes time. People start spending. Their businesses think, maybe I'll invest a bit, maybe I won't. It takes time. And, so this is the process we're going through. So I just push back against the idea that what we're doing isn't working. I think we'd be in a more difficult position if we had not cut interest rates last year.
Our last question, and hopefully it's one question. David Rogers.
Dr. Lowe, thanks for such a candid speech. And I just want to ask you, you said that rising asset prices and risk-taking can be a good thing for the global economy, but it can have too much of a good thing. Can you give us an indication of how close we might be to too much of a good thing and what the FSA is looking at in regard to that?
Kind of both globally, and I think it's an issue domestically as well. Kind of, as I said,
couple of times. The effects of the interest rates cuts so far have been positive. They've encouraged people to kind of pay back their debts a bit more quickly and pushed up asset prices. But it is possible we get to the point where the lower interest rates don't just encourage people to pay their debts more quickly or allow them to do that, but actually encourage other people to take on more debt. And if that happens, then asset prices could go up further. So this is why we're watching trends in debt so carefully, because we wouldn't like to see lower interest rates just encourage another borrowing boom and the same discussions taking place internationally. At the moment, credit growth around the world is not particularly high, but there are pockets. The leveraged loan market in the US is one example of that, where there is a greater willingness to take risk, and the international communities, regulatory communities, concerned about that. So at the moment, I think it's okay, but there's a concern that we could be getting close to a crossover point where what's been a good thing may not be such a good thing in the future. There's no kind of precise point at which we get to that crossover point, so it's a judgment issue, and we're just trying to follow it very carefully, both here and overseas.
Sorry,
yep.
That thing in the US market you were looking at, what market was stretched?
The kind of the leveraged loan market, and there's been a lot of kind of corporates issuing very low-rated debt, you know, with quite weak covenants. So there's quite a lot of concern, particularly in the United States, that that market could be too exuberant.
Okay.